Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday Interview Edition. And today, just a minute ago, everyone, he just left. I had my my friend Craig Johnson in here. I met Craig as the prop master for the Stuff You Should Know TV show years ago. And Craig and I just hit it off. He's a good dude. We have a lot in common. We have similar taste and interest. And we were set pals, which is always fun. It's so much fun working on a TV show, guys, and to hang out. And it's such a familial experience. And you end up just becoming really close with these people. And you goof off and you have a good time. And you're eating lunch together all day and working and tireless hours. And it's a real bonding experience. So Craig and his now wife, they were just boyfriend-girlfriend at the time, Karen Freed. She worked as our lead wardrobe costumer, and they work both now on Stranger Things. It's kind of cool. You know, they get to work together some as a married couple, which is great because there's such long hours and it can be very hard on a marriage, the film business. So if you get on the same gig, it's kind of good because you get to spend time with one another. And so Karen works in the wardrobe department on Stranger Things. Going to have her in here for the final part four until I get those Duffer Brothers. And this is part three of the Stranger Things special. Craig works as an on-set dresser, and as you will soon find out, has inserted some pretty cool Easter eggs on that show with his own musical venture, Space Knife, which you should check out on YouTube. It's really great stuff. Craig is a child of the 80s, much like myself, a great lover of all things 80s. And so his movie pick, as a sci-fi nut himself, was The Thing. And so that's what we talk about right here and right now. Please to enjoy. Yeah, let's talk about the TV show. What went wrong?
I don't know.
I think it was okay.
I liked it. I had a lot of fun working on it.
Yeah, me too. I think that was the thing, is we had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
We were, I think, I'm not going to pretend we were like groundbreaking, but we were a bit ahead of our time.
I think so.
For like a podcast doing their thing on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that years later, it's sort of happening a lot more now. And like people writing articles about all these podcasts on TV, but no one ever mentions like the Trailblazers.
It's like, we already did that.
People have come back. We've had like not offers, but because now our network is with an agency.
Mm-hmm.
Like Joss and I aren't, but the whole network is. And they've come back and been like, hey, you guys want to take another stab at it? And I'm always kind of like, not really. Like, I'm fine. Like, I think I like the audio thing.
Yeah.
It's good for me.
It's like, we tried that and we did it.
Yeah.
It's fun.
It's like, have you seen the first thing?
Yeah.
Like, maybe we could do something more normal.
If you look behind you, the thing is falling off the wall.
Yeah, this whole studio is falling apart. That one fell off the other day. And I just set it on the floor. how's Josh Zills doing, by the way?
Oh, he's great.
Yeah?
Yeah, I see him. I'm actually going to hang out with him tonight.
Oh, cool.
Is
he in Atlanta?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he moved here almost right before started shooting. Stuff
yeah,
you should know.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, he was a good friend from a long time ago.
Yeah. Let's talk about your background.
Yeah.
Alabama, right?
Yeah, Decatur, Alabama.
Which is, I know I've heard of that. Where is that?
It's near Huntsville. It's about an hour north of Birmingham.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And near the Space Center,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome.
Which is great.
What did you go there when you were a kid? Was that like the school trip?
I went there a couple of times.
Yeah.
They actually have a space camp there that I never got to go to.
Yeah.
So that was kind of sad.
I know that movie.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big one for me
growing up. Yeah, they filmed it there.
Oh, did they really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool.
Parts of it, they actually filmed there.
Right. So how does a guy like you come from Alabama?
I don't know.
Not to make fun of Alabama. Alabama's great.
No, Alabama's great. But I was definitely the grunge kid at my high school.
Okay.
Like everybody was very sports.
Yeah, sure.
You know, oriented and hunt and fish.
Yes.
And then I was the grunge kid.
The sport of kill.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I was.
I would think you were a bit of a, not an outcast, but like a black sheep.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Had very few friends in high school. the ones I did have were the few that were there that were kind of like me.
Right.
But yeah, there wasn't very many.
Yeah. And you don't have an accent kind of like me. Mm-hmm. Although some of my friends make fun of me, like some of my LA friends say I have like this huge Southern accent. I'm like, no, I don't. I really just don't.
Yeah. It's like, I don't hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have words as you might as well, like not sayings, but expressions and certain words we'll use.
And it comes up more when I start drinking.
Yeah.
It definitely seeps out a little bit.
Yeah. You want to kill some deer?
Yeah.
Were you in music in high school? Because I definitely want to talk about and let everyone know about Space Knife.
Oh.
But let's go back to the beginning of the music stuff.
I was in band for like 1 year.
And like the marching band?
In the marching band, playing saxophone for like a year. And
oh, which one?
It's alto sax.
Okay. I played tenor sax for 1 year.
Nice.
When I was actually in elementary school.
It was fun, but I never really got into it.
Yeah.
And then I think the Nirvana Nevermind album came out, and I was like, I have to get a guitar.
Oh, okay. So that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was kind of the turning point that made me actually want to start playing music.
Yeah. What was your first guitar?
It was a Kramer Focus.
Oh, nice. What is the deal with like – why has no one ever gotten a cool, good first guitar? Because mine was awful. It was a metal – it was a BC Rich red, cherry red. And of course, in my defense, it was – I mean, shit, man. I was 13, so it was like 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And I was Eddie Van Halen crazy.
Sure.
Which I still am.
Yeah.
So that was my excuse. What's up with the Kramer?
I actually had to buy it myself, and it was cheap.
Oh, okay.
I could afford to buy – I'd saved up enough money. I could buy that and a small Marshall Mini Stack used for like very cheap. So I could afford to buy both of them.
Right.
I could either afford to buy a nice guitar, no amp, or a cheap guitar and a cheap amp.
Well, that's a good point because my guitar was pretty cheap, and it's not like when you're 13 – you have the money to go out and buy a Les Paul Standard, you know?
Yeah.
Like, let me go drop $6,000. Yeah, so that makes sense. And were you self-taught?
Well, I was going to church a lot as a kid, and I was started playing in the
– I did that.
Church band, yeah. Yeah.
We didn't have a band, though.
Yeah.
They didn't allow that.
It was like on I was self-taught up to a point, and then I started playing like on
– And then God took over.
Yeah. And then God came into my heart, and I could play awesome. But no, I got asked to play like in the youth group band on Wednesday nights.
Yeah.
And my cousin, who's a drummer, is an amazing drummer.
Uh-huh.
And there was another guy that was playing guitar, and they were both phenomenal, you know, musicians.
Yeah.
So it was me trying to like catch up to them while we would practice. And so I learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's what they say you should do
in
kind of everything in life, like sports and music, like surround yourself with people better than you, and that's the way you get better and challenge yourself or whatever.
Yeah, it definitely helped because before that I was just everything was just bar chords over and over again. And then playing with these guys, like I had to learn. I was actually going back and forth between guitar and bass at the time. So that kind of – I think that helped because I was playing a lot of bass with those guys.
Right.
And then translating that back to guitar, actually doing more with my fingers than just playing –
Sure.
You know, regular chords.
Yeah. I still can't play three notes of a solo together. Like, I've just never learned. I've been playing guitar now for 30 something years. And it's embarrassing. Like, you know, when you go to the guitar store and everyone's like, has their noodle jam that they do to test things out. I have none. I'm always like, let me just play my chords. But I'm a rhythm guitar player. And
exactly.
I had to write that with myself and be like, you know what? I'm not a solo player. That's why we have a lead guitar player.
Yeah, exactly. I never could do solos.
You can do some solos. I've seen you.
Yeah.
More than me. Trust me, man. Like, I literally cannot play single notes. It just feels weird and awkward and I never learn. It's like if you played left-handed and you're right-handed. That's how it feels. It's that bad. Are you doing other band stuff besides Space Knife right now?
I just write a lot of music.
Yeah.
And it's kind of all over the place. A lot of like either just guitar rock or synth stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But for the past year, it's been mostly just synth stuff, doing writing stuff for Space Knife.
All right. Well, let's not beat around the bush. For everyone listening, Space Knife is it's sort of like Pedro the Lion is David Bazan. Like, you are Space Knife.
Yeah.
It's not a group per se.
No.
Except just you, right?
Yeah. Well, in the videos, it's me and then a bunch of other me in the background playing the keyboards.
Right. It's a bunch of views.
It's just more of me. Yeah.
Yeah. So how many songs can you find on YouTube?
There are 4 music videos on YouTube right now.
And what are the names of these songs?
The first one, I wrote a song about a jetpack, and it was before there was anything about Space Knife.
Right.
And I just wrote a song about a jetpack, and my roommate and I made a video for it.
Uh-huh.
And then the second song I did, I wrote a song about a space knife, and I was like, oh, wait, that's a good name. So I wound up retroactively naming the band Space Knife for the first song. And,
after the song.
Yeah.
Which is after an object.
Yes.
Okay. Which was a space knife.
Exactly.
And which is the one with the parenthetical in the title? Shield.
I'm taking off Shield Your Eyes.
Shield Your Eyes. And Shield Your Eyes is in parentheses, which is a classic rock motif. I'm glad you're bringing it back.
Trying to. There was a time when I was doing an EP and like I was going to have every song be that way.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Oh, parenthetical. God. I love it, dude. How would you describe Space Knife, though? It's like, how would you describe it?
It's very like new wave pop, 80s synth pop.
But, I mean, there's a tongue in the cheek, but you're not, like, making fun of that music at all. It's, like, embracing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think people just need to check it out to fully get what's going on.
Yeah, because it started out as a humorous thing.
Yeah.
But then...
But it's good. It's, like, really good music.
And,
like, the videos, it looks pulled straight out of, like, 1983.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's what we found this video camera that we were going to shoot one of the videos with, that we did shoot the Space Knife music video with. And when we turned it on, the date that the last time it had been turned on was 1983.
Wow.
And so that's where we kind of based Space Knife in that year.
You retrofitted it.
And we were going to make like a fake documentary about Space Knife. Being from the 80s and then interviewing all the band members now, but me playing all the band members, but just never talking about the fact that we all look the same. Just,
are you still going to do that?
I would love to.
Because it's sort of, I mean, it's like a performance art project, but at the center of it is this really good 80s synthy music.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, man. And it has since taken on a new life because of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. You guys were kind enough to help hook me up with the fellas for the interview with Harbor and Kiri and Gelman.
Mm-hmm.
Stranger Things Part 1 and 2. This is officially Stranger Things Part 3. what is your official job? Are you prop master?
No. No, I'm the on-set dresser.
Okay.
So I deal with the sets while we're shooting and make sure the sets look good on camera.
Right.
Try to maintain continuity of everything. While we're shooting.
Right.
Basically, I'm moving a lot of furniture around to make room for camera and then making sure it all goes back into place.
Sure. But are you dressing the set to begin with?
No. I come in when it's already been set.
Okay.
It's already been dressed. And I come in with the shooting crew.
Uh-huh.
So I'm kind of like the set deck representative while we're actually shooting.
Right. Which I know because I've been on shoots before. But for everyone listening, like, you're there. It's a cool gig because you're there during all the fun stuff, which is when cameras are rolling and actors are acting. You're kind of right there closely watching to zoom in there and do whatever needs to be done, prop-wise, right? And set.
No, set-wise, not props.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Props
got to
be handled differently, right?
It is. I was prop master on the Stuff You Should Know show.
Right.
But on this, I'm an on-set dresser.
Well, and Stuff You Should Know, everyone. There was a lot of cross-pollination.
Yeah. I did a lot on that one, too.
But for these shows, the bigger shows, it's a little more specific.
Exactly.
As to what you do.
Yeah. I work a lot with the directors and director of photography to make sure they're happy with the sets. And so it's cool. I just get to, you know, actually get to work with the directors and, you know, the DPs a lot. It's, I don't know, it's really fun.
Yeah. So what are the Duffers like? What are those dudes like? I am going to get them in here one day. I'm determined. To get both those guys?
They're great. They're super nice and very knowledgeable about this, you know, the type of show they're making.
They, right.
You know, it's definitely a love letter to that kind of stuff that they grew up with.
Yeah. And they're they have a super specific vision, but I've also heard that they're pretty collaborative in general, right?
Oh, very much so. Like I've even, you know, would suggest something and they'll be like, yeah, that sounds good. Or like Karen, my wife, she was the assistant costume designer.
Uh-huh. Who's going to be a guest as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she threw out a lot of ideas for wardrobe and they're like, yeah, that works. And so they're very open to, you know, anybody's opinion. It's really good.
That's cool.
It's really cool.
And they run a pretty fun set.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, it's super busy.
Yeah, it's ambitious.
There's a lot of, especially this season was the biggest thing I've worked on, I think.
Yeah.
It was huge. But they try to keep it fun and not stressful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
But it's a lot of work. I mean, we're always working nonstop the whole time.
Well, yeah, because you guys are putting together like these mini movies every week. I mean, each season has grown in scope and budget.
Mm-hmm.
I know you can't really talk about this upcoming season, but with the way those Gelman and those guys were teasing it, it sounds pretty great.
It's like I love season one and two, but I think this season is it's so big.
Yeah,
I'm really excited about watching it.
I
want to watch it, and I know everything that happens.
Right, right.
I know everything that's going to happen, but I'm so excited to watch it.
Uh huh. Yeah, that kind of says it all.
Mm-hmm.
I thought season two was better than season one, even.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people did. I did see some people like poo-pooing it, but I thought it was great.
I liked it. I think I liked season one better.
Oh, really?
I think I just liked the story better.
Yeah, there was something to the newness of because now, I mean, of course, because of the success of that, there have been movies now coming out and other things that are like, hey, let's do that. Let's go back to the early 80s, which is great.
Yeah, which is great because I love all that stuff.
Yeah, but Stranger Things kind of started it for sure.
Yeah, I was talking to the Duffers about that on set and they were talking about how like everybody's ripping them off. Even though, but they're ripping off everybody else.
Right. Well, it's an homage.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, that's cool, though, that they got that opportunity. Because mm-hmm. This is the first thing they've done, right?
They've done, they did an indie feature. And they've been writing for a while.
Right.
On other stuff.
I think they just
developed this concept and had, got to pitch it.
Yeah.
And apparently pitched it to a lot of networks before Netflix finally picked it up.
Well, Netflix is – I watched that Coen Brothers anthology, the Buster Scruggs, the other day and was reading an interview with them. And they asked why Netflix and they were like, because they're the people that are funding like good shit right now. He said they're the only studio that's not intent on just hammering reboots and remakes and sequels. And he's like, that's some of the best like original content out there they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, so that's why we went to Netflix. Yeah. It's like pretty simple. And it's like same thing with Stranger Things, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Netflix, they seem to be making so much original content.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it.
It's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you deal with the network people at all ever?
No, I never see anybody.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's how it should be, I guess.
Yeah. I don't really see a lot of like, I don't know what happens, offset, but while we're there, like I don't see people coming in and telling the Duffers, you guys should shoot something like this instead.
Right.
It's like they seem to be left alone to make what they want to make.
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's smart.
Yeah, I
think
so.
When you have like two creatives like that. That's awesome, man. I need to get those dudes in here. So what about growing up for you? I mean, obviously, how old are you now actually?
40.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I always just think of you guys as kids still. You're not that far behind me then.
Mm-mm.
I mean, 7 years, but for some reason, I mean, I guess stuff you should know was a little while ago, but 40.
Yeah, 40.
Damn, Greg.
This year, yeah, March.
What's your birthday?
The March 23rd.
Oh, okay, I'm the 15th.
Nice.
Fellow Pisces, or are you?
Aries.
Sorry about that. I don't even know what Aries means or Pisces. None of it means anything. So, all right, then. That makes a little bit more sense because I know how like how much you love the 80s,
mm-hmm.
but I was always like, Craig's too young to have lived through the 80s. But that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You were born then in what?
78.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you were in your formative years.
Yeah, I think that's why like everything I do, like because I, you know, write scripts, write short films, but in music I write, it's all very 80s inspired,
yeah,
you know, 80s influenced.
Yeah.
Because that's what was so important to me at the time. Because, you know, living with my mom, she was super big into 80s movies, all those movies in the 80s and music.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother and younger sister.
Oh, okay.
But they're much younger.
Gotcha.
Yeah. My sister is 8 years younger. My brother's 13 years younger.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So you were getting your cultural feed from your mom largely?
Mostly, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, because she and she loves science fiction. She loves fantasy movies.
Oh, really?
She loves action movies.
Oh, that's awesome.
And she loves and a lot of like 80s pop. So that's where I got
yeah
my love for 80s pop came from. It's just like listening to top 40 radio.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You guys still close?
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I don't get to go home as much as I want to.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's only like 4 hours away. It's not that far. But
yeah,
when you're working on a show, it's like—
Yeah, that's all you do.
Your whole life is just that show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if people understand that. When you're on a show like this or a movie, mm-hmm. are you guys doing 6 day weeks or 5 day weeks?
Most of the time it's 5 day weeks.
But you're doing stuff probably.
You're doing like minimum 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And usually, your Fridays can usually spill over into your Saturday.
Right.
So it's really, most of the time you don't even have like a real weekend.
Yeah, so you're going to work and you're coming home and then you're sleeping.
Exactly.
And then you're getting up and then you're going to work and then you're coming home and you're sleeping. And that's just for how many months did you guys shoot?
This one went April to November.
Oh, man.
It was a long one. It was the longest one I've done.
Yeah. That's a good gig, though.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, that's your financial year right there.
Yeah, for the most part.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Except for, you know, designing the Stuff You Should Know Christmas show, which you guys did a great job, by the way.
Oh, thank you. That was a lot of fun.
It was amazing. But let's talk about Space Knife on Stranger Things, mm-hmm. because a lot of listeners to the show love Stranger Things, and I don't know how many people have noticed the Easter eggs. So how did that happen, and how did you talk those guys into inserting yourself into their TV show?
My boss, the set decorator, Jess Royal, she came up to me and asked if I wanted to – this is during season one.
Okay.
Asked if I wanted to make anything, like make a fake commercial or make something just to be on a TV in the background because they were just looking for stuff to fill it. But I didn't have time and then to make anything. And she was like, well, what if I offer your Space Knife videos? Because she had seen them.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yes, please. So she sent all three that I had at the time – to them, and they went out picking one and putting it on a TV in the background. And the song is playing. The song is playing for like 30 seconds.
Which one is it?
The I'm Taking Off.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, camera pans by, you see me like, you know, really quick on the TV, and my song is playing for the whole scene.
So
it's crazy.
Great. And what episode is that? For people that want to go seek that out.
Episode two.
Of season one.
Of season one.
All right. And you were also, there is a, what other Easter eggs? There's a video game?
That's in season two, but also in season one, in like episode seven, there's a movie theater and there's like a small Space Knife, the movie poster.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's really small. It's really hard to see, but yeah. But I've worked that in there. But in season two, there is we made a fake video game.
Yeah, an arcade game, right? Mm-hmm.
I did animation for an actual game. We were going to try to have somebody pretending like they're playing it, but we didn't have time to get like a... the arcade cabinet with a TV that we could put in there. So we just did the artwork. It just had to be like out of order in the back.
Gotcha.
And then.
So that's in the arcade scene. You can see the Space Knife arcade game.
Yeah. It's in like the back room in the back office.
All right.
And then in Brett Gelman's house in season two, there's a Space Knife record you can see pretty clearly.
That's right.
Yeah.
And is that it?
I think in the house party scene, the Halloween scene, in season two, like I think I wrote Space Knife rules on the.
you think you did?
I did, but I don't know if you can see it or not. It's the camera passes by it really fast. But I wrote Space Knife rules like in marker on the refrigerator.
RULZ.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, you got to put the L's. Yeah,
the preferred
Z in there.
Spelling. Yeah. Well, that's great, man. It's so cool. Like every time I saw something Space Knife on there, and you're in my phone as Space Knife,
nice.
Which is hysterical. So hopefully, we said the words Space Knife 48 times. And everyone just needs to check it out. And you gave me a sneak peek of your new video.
Mm-hmm.
Can you even say what you did there or would that get you in trouble?
I don't think so. No. So in the very last day of shooting,
mm-hmm.
There were two sets that were still built for season 3 of Stranger Things that we were done shooting in, but they haven't taken them down yet.
Yeah.
And the production designer and the Duffer brothers were nice enough to let me go in there and shoot
Space Knife video.
A Space Knife video in those two sets. But they said, you can do it as long as you don't release it until after the show comes out.
Right.
That's fine.
And you shot it during lunch, correct?
Yeah.
Over 30 minutes?
Yeah, we had like 30 minutes to go. And so we did like 2 takes in each set really fast.
So great, dude.
Yeah.
It looked really good.
Oh, thank you.
And the production value, like the production value is built in because of these great sets.
Yeah, the sets are amazing.
But the fact that you were still able to even get something workable in 30 minutes is just amazing.
Fortunately, the one set had built-in practical lights, and the other one I had brought in 2 lights, and so I had set those up earlier in the day, so it was ready to go. So as soon as we broke for lunch, went and changed my outfit, just ran in there and we just shot it really quick.
Into your Space Knife blazer, is that correct?
It was like a black jean jacket.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Such good stuff, man. You got sweet moves.
Thank you.
Everyone support Space Knife. Go look up the videos on YouTube. It is really good 80s music, and I know you're working on like a legit album to be released at some point, which I'm just super excited about.
Hopefully I have it done so I can release it right around the time Stranger Things season 3 comes out.
Sure. Capitalize on that.
Try to ride that wave.
Get a little juice. All right, dude. Well, let's get into the thing. I know you debated a little bit about Alien or The Thing. Is that right?
There were several movies I was thinking of, and it was funny, 3 of them were Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
Oh, interesting. I just got kind of killed recently for talking about how Stallone was far more talented than Schwarzenegger. And some people on Facebook got really mad at me. I think Arnold's great. He can throw a dude out a window and say a line and chomp on a cigar. It's perfect for those movies. But as I just made the argument that Stallone's sheer talent for writing films and making and writing Rocky and
other
great movies. But I didn't mean to disparage the Governator. He's great. What movies? Terminator 2?
Terminator 2.
Sure.
Predator.
Okay.
And the first Conan movie.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie so much.
Yeah. What is it about sci-fi for you?
I don't know. I don't know if it's because of my parents that loved it so much, or I had, 2 older cousins that were super into it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my cousins had Star Wars on tape. And so every time I would go to his house, we would watch it.
Yeah.
Until I was able to, get my own copy at the house.
Sure.
But yeah, I just love science fiction. It was always what appealed to me. The main thing I wanted to watch. I wanted to watch Star Wars every day. And as soon as I discovered the Aliens movies, I just wanted to watch those every day.
Yeah.
God, I love them so much.
Yeah, that first, someone will pick Alien at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one's great. Mm-hmm. And there has been bits of greatness since then, too.
Yeah. I enjoyed the third one. I didn't really care for the fourth one, and I haven't really cared for Prometheus or Covenant.
They look great.
They look great.
But there is something missing.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about those first two, and for me especially that first one. I remember my brother, that was one of the movies that I wasn't allowed to see, and I have a brother 3 years older. So he did this a few times where he would go see a movie, and then we would sit up at night, and he would tell me the movie.
Nice.
Almost in real time. I remember specifically him telling me Alien, and it took over an hour. So it wasn't quite real time, but he really went through the whole thing because I was like, and then what happened? And then what happened? And it's like, and then they bled milk, and then the blood was acid, and then it came out of the guy's chest. And that was how I saw those movies in my mind's eye, was through that and Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
Reading the movie spoofs.
There was also the magazines Starlog.
Yeah.
That would come out that I could go and I could read those at the bookstore.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of those old movie magazines. There was another one that was
Fangoria?
Fangoria, yeah.
Yeah.
It's both of those. I loved them.
Yeah. Are you into horror as well, or is it?
Not as much as science fiction.
Uh-huh.
But I do love the sci-fi horror crossovers, The Thing and Alien and Predator.
Where does this fit in, The Thing, for you? Do you remember your first experience with it?
It had to have been like late at night on HBO at a friend's house or at a cousin's house or something. Because I don't think I would have seen it.
I didn't see it in the theater for sure.
Yeah, I definitely didn't
see it. It was like I think probably a VHS deal for me. Mm-hmm. And it was 1982. Escape from New York was just before this. Mm-hmm. And that was my first R-rated movie that I saw at all. But it was on VHS at a dude's house. And so the thing, like after I had gotten permission, and I've told this story before, but being, you know, raised in a Southern Baptist sort of conservative household, like I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But once that wall had been broken, then it was kind of like, all right, you can watch The Thing and, you know, movies like this. I wasn't watching Porky's, but although I super wanted to because I didn't know it was just a shitty movie.
Yeah, I my mom was never – she never really – stop me from watching horror or sci-fi.
That's great.
Yeah, she never really – if it's something she thought was going to be really bad, she would, you know, send me to wait to watch it. But for the most part, she just kind of trusted me to, you know, watch what I thought I could handle.
Yeah, I think that was the same thing for me. I was always a good kid and proved myself trustworthy with stuff. I wasn't getting into trouble. I wasn't sneaking out and getting drunk back then. I probably missed out, but
yeah, same. I think I probably missed out,
but we do that now.
Yes,
as I sit here with a slight hangover. All right, so 1982, one of the great years for movies. Period. Mm-hmm. Kurt Russell, of course, peak Kurt Russell, probably. I think from like 82 to 87.
Yeah,
81 to 87.
I think at the time he still wasn't like the biggest star just yet. But I mean, but as far as like. My favorite Kurt Russell movies.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember seeing him as a kid in those early Disney movies when he was like a child actor. So he had always been around, but that 80 to 86, I looked up his resume, and from 80 to 86, it started with Used Cars, which is just a great,
so good.
Great 80s comedy. Felt 70s still because it was 80. To 86, which was Big Trouble in Little China. Mm-hmm. Like over that 6 years, he really put out some great stuff. And then, I mean, depending on how you feel about movies like Overboard, he continued to make good movies.
Yeah. I remember liking that movie. I mean, but I was a kid when it came out.
Yeah.
So I don't really.
Sure.
I haven't seen it in 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. But Kurt Russell to me was always one of those guys that like, I mean, he made movies. He was an actor in movies that were fun popcorn movies.
Yeah.
Like, I can't think of many he made that were, like, you know, sort of serious dramas or Oscar bait. Like, he was sort of like a throwback to me to, like, movie star guys. He's iron-jawed, like, men.
Yeah, exactly.
That jaw on that guy.
It's like watching movies like, you know, Tombstone.
Yeah.
Where he's so good in it. And then going from that to Captain Ron, you know.
Yeah.
Just like, I love everything that he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was always like fan-centric, though, it felt like. Like, you're going to love this movie. It's like, you don't have to think too hard about it, maybe. Mm-hmm. But he was always great.
Yeah.
Like, Snake Plissken is, I can't wait for someone to pick that movie.
I almost picked that one. That was another one on my list.
So great.
I had a huge list. I kept texting and then deleting it and then texting and deleting it. Like, maybe, what about this one? Like, I was like, nah.
Well, it's funny, too, because Escape from L.A. is one of the worst movies I've seen.
It's terrible.
Someone might think it's kitsch appeal or something, but it's weird that it looked worse than the original movie. Mm-hmm. Years later, they managed to make a movie that looked more dated than one in 1981. It's crazy.
I think with more money – maybe there wasn't like the vision that he had.
Yeah.
You know, there was too much money to make that vision. Like in the first one, there wasn't that much. The budget wasn't that big.
Yeah.
So he had to be kind of focused on what he wanted. And the second one just seemed way overblown.
Yeah. And it was such a carbon copy. Mm-hmm. To the point where it was just like, I was disappointed in John Carpenter.
Yeah.
It's like, man, you're John Carpenter. Like, you could do better than this.
And you have so many other times.
Yeah. Like, you could make an Escape from L.A. movie that's better than this by not doing sort of – I mean, it had the same exact plot line, the same ticking clock, and instead of the glider, he's in that underground, what was it, like a sub or something?
He has like a weird boat thing.
Yeah, it was just like just exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
So disappointing. But with the thing, let's get into that. First of all, watching it again two nights ago, I always forget about that very first shot of the spaceship.
Oh, yeah.
In outer space. Which I don't know why I forget about that.
Because I guess it's so quick and it's over so quick and you don't actually see the ship landing. It's just like a quick flyby and then it's kind of forgotten about.
It's totally forgotten about until they get to where it's buried under ice.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, seeing that, I wish I had the Criterion, like the 4K mm-hmm. DVD. But I did – I mean it was a pretty decent looking stream, I guess, that I watched. But that's set of the thing under ice is just – it holds up. It's so good looking.
It's a matte painting.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's like the ship when they're standing and looking at it. Yeah, it's just a big matte – it's a big matte painting.
I figured that's what it was. It's so funny that like those throwback effects mm-hmm. like still look better.
It's – yeah, I watched it. I have the 4K version of it and I watched it this morning. It's such a beautiful movie. Everything about it looks great.
It does.
Yeah.
It really does.
And they did it so seamlessly with those matte paintings and, like, I don't know, all the lighting that the DP did. I don't know. It's beautiful.
Who was the DP? Do you remember?
Dean Cundey, uh-huh. was his name. Like, he did a lot of the John Carpenter stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I went back and saw the original Halloween this year as well
because
I saw the new one in the movie theaters. And then it might have even been Halloween night. After Emily and Ruby went to bed, I put on the original. Just so great, man. Carpenter, like, I should do like a series on him.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of the true geniuses.
Yeah, he really knows how to capture that specific look.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, and a tone that he has, I feel like, through his mm-hmm. work. With the music, although he didn't do the music on this. I always thought he did.
He did. I was watching a behind-the-scenes thing, and he did, like, small pieces.
Did he?
Yeah. The majority of it was the
Ennio Morricone.
Morricone, yeah. But then there's, like, small pieces here and there that he did little synth stuff just to fill in the pieces.
All right, because I did notice a few of those, and I was like, that's got to be John Carpenter.
Yeah. Yeah, but he basically gives all the credit to Morricone. But, like, but he did a few things.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I wonder why he felt like he had to hire it out.
I read somewhere where he said he liked him so much that he used Morricone's music at his wedding.
Oh.
And he just...
So he just wanted to work with him.
I think he just wanted to work with him, yeah.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that that score was nominated for a Razzie as the worst score.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Which is crazy to me.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still have it. I listen to a lot of scores when I'm writing, and that's one of the ones I go to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea. I never mm-hmm. thought about that.
I listen to, and it's a lot of John Carpenter scores from his movies.
The
really moody, synthy stuff.
Yeah.
I love listening to that when I'm writing.
Yeah. Noel here, who co-hosts on the Mini Crushes, he mm-hmm. he's goes deep with the Carpenter stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, that's good. I need to start listening to that. That's a good idea to do it while you're writing. So the movie opens in one of the most upsetting ways you can open a film, which is a helicopter and a guy with a rifle trying to kill a dog for a fucking bizarrely long time.
It
feels like it just goes on and on.
It's a long opening scene.
I'm just like, go, dog, go. Keep going. It's really upsetting as a dog guy.
But then afterwards, you're kind of like, oh, wait, I kind of wish he would have killed him.
Well.
Afterwards.
Sure. Because the dog is – is the dog at that point mm-hmm. already
– Oh, yeah. That's why they're trying to kill it because – it's escaped from the Norwegian camp.
Okay.
And so they're trying to track it down and kill it before it gets to, before it spreads.
Right. Because the Norwegian camp has already undergone the
mm-hmm.
The thing or whatever.
Yeah. And I read what the pilot was saying when he was screaming at the guys. And he's screaming like, it's not a dog. It's a thing pretending to be a dog. Get away from it. You're like,
oh, really?
Yeah.
I wonder why I didn't subtitle that.
I think because it would have given it away.
That's a good point. It's like, that was a dumb question. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So they come in. Kurt Russell has is – it's funny watching it now. Like as a kid, I'm like, yeah, man, the tough guys. This is like drinking that scotch.
Drinking J&B and playing chess.
But now when I watch it, I'm like, he's an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. He's drinking the whole movie
on the job,
yeah.
on the lookout while he's working before he flies. It's like he has a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. As a kid, you just don't even notice those things. It's so funny.
He's just up in his shack all by himself,
getting drunk on scotch.
Yeah, it's getting wasted.
And everywhere he goes, he grabs that scotch.
He's always got it with him.
One of the I pulled some bad reviews, and we'll get to that later because this movie was hated.
Yeah, the opening shot, he's got the whiskey bottle, and then the ending shot, he's got the whiskey bottle.
One of the guys from the original version of this from 1951, one of the original filmmakers panned it, and he said, here it is. He said, if you want blood, go to the slaughterhouse. All in all, it's just a terrific commercial for J&B Scotch. Yeah. And it is pretty heavily, like, they had to have gotten some money.
Probably, because it's in there a lot, and that label is facing out. You see it a lot.
Every single time. Just so bizarre. Like, he grabs it to go do, like, to fight the thing. He'll grab, like, the gun and his bottle of scotch. It's crazy, which he douses the chess game with, because he can't lose to that computer.
Oh, he's so pissed.
He's just so fucking cool looking in this movie too. Mm-hmm. That beard and that hair, man. He's always had that beautiful hair.
I read that where it took him like a year to grow the beard and the hair out for this role. Like, I guess he had it cut for whatever movie before that.
He'd never cut it again, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not true, but I feel like he's still got that hair.
He's still got it.
I saw a picture of him the other day. It's like he's just
it's got beautiful. That.
Yeah, he's it's a beautiful man. Hair, beautiful coif. God bless Kurt Russell. I'm so glad that Tarantino sort of Tarantino'd him.
Oh, for
Just get him back with Death Proof and kind of everything else now.
Like Hateful Eight, which is kind of related to The Thing a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
He said it was – Tarantino said it was like The Thing is what kind of inspired, inspired Hateful Eight.
I didn't really
like,
think about it.
You know, people in the snow.
Isolated in the snow.
Yeah.
Who's guilty, who's not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because it's a sci-fi film with elements of horror. But at the root of it, it sort of becomes a like an Agatha Christie.
Yeah, whodunit kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like one of us is the killer, except one of us is the thing, which is one of my favorite sort of subgenres is to watch a movie like that.
Where you have no idea who's done it, and like they're all trying to figure it out.
Yeah, man. I've always wanted to write a movie and everyone is sort of like Clue, like – everyone's in the mansion and one of us is dead and one of us did it. And we have to figure it out before sunrise.
I just bought there's a board game for The Thing.
I think I heard about that.
It came out last year, but it's awesome. But it's basically Clue.
Oh, really?
And you're trying to figure out who's infected and who's not. And you're trying to the people that aren't are trying to escape. I don't know. It's an awesome game.
Yeah. I teased the episode on Facebook today. On the Movie Crush page, and someone talked about the game.
Yeah,
is it fun?
Oh, it's great! I love it. It's
and the design, is it cool?
It's everything about it is. You can tell they did a lot. They put a lot of work into it.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a beautiful game.
Man, I need to get that.
Yeah, it's really good. Like Mondo. I don't know if you know them. Like, they're the ones that I think they're the ones that put it out.
Now, are they the ones that do the cool movie posters?
They do a lot of posters. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think I saw one for this one. That was sort of it was an alternate take on that iconic, like one of the great movie posters of all time.
The one with the guy and he's standing there.
Yeah. And which the lights blown out of his face.
Yeah, which John Carpenter hated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he didn't want the movie to be a guy in a suit. And so when the poster came over, he's like, it looks like a guy in a suit.
Uh-huh.
Because he didn't want, he wanted to get away from that kind of thing.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then the guy that did the poster – He'd been giving very little detail about what the movie is.
Uh-huh.
I basically did it in a night.
Oh, really?
Sent it over.
Huh.
Yeah.
I'd never done any exploration on the original book that it came from until this interview. And I don't know how much you know about it, but it really is like almost the exact same thing as the movie. I mean, they change a couple of little elements here and there. But it's really, really similar, which I was kind of surprised for some reason. I thought it would be just sort of like heavily adapted and changed.
Yeah, I think he didn't want to make the movie, the first movie again. He wanted to go back to the source material because the original movie was so different from the book.
Have you seen that one, the 51?
Mm-hmm.
Is it good?
It's fine. It's like a just 50s sci-fi
sure.
guy walking around. Right. But it's just like a fun old sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like the John Carpenter version.
Right. What about the remake, recent one? Did you see that?
The prequel.
Oh, is that what it was?
It's a prequel, yeah.
Oh, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it deals with the, like, it kind of deals with the Norwegian camp.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Huh.
I enjoyed it. It's not nearly as good.
Yeah.
There's a lot of CG.
Sure.
But, you know, it's still fun to watch.
All right, I'm going to have to check that out. I thought it was a straight-up remake.
No.
And so I was just like, fuck that.
No, it's a prequel.
All right, well, I'll check that out then. Mm-hmm. Who's in that? It's got a... I said actress's name.
I know Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Yeah.
She's in it.
I like her. She's
yeah,
good.
She's cool. I'm trying to think who else was in it. I don't remember. I saw it in the theater and I haven't seen it since.
All right. I'm going to have to check that out then. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. We need to talk a little bit about the hat on Kurt Russell, that cowboy hat. Well, do you know anything about this?
The kind of sombrero that's like folded up on the edges.
Yeah. Like what the deal is, where he came up with that, why. It's such a weird choice.
In all of the behind the scenes stuff that I've read or interviews that I've read, I've never seen anywhere where he mentions the hat or like
if really?
It, or like whose idea it was or.
Because it's so, so like attention grabbing.
It's a very iconic thing for his character.
Yeah.
Wearing that hat and those glasses.
Yeah. I had a pair of those glasses, by the way.
That hooked over his ears.
Yeah, the wraparound, and then the sides had the little leather.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were – I mean, obviously, it kind of fits for where they were because they're like snow glasses
mm-hmm.
to keep out that blinding reflection. But I clearly got those because of this movie. Like there was no other reason for me living in Stone Mountain, Georgia to have Antarctic snow glasses. I had two pairs of sunglasses because of characters. I got those
mm-hmm.
and I got the I was a big Moonlighting fan and Bruce Willis had these sunglasses that are now the look on there, the Ray-Ban, I can't remember which model, the one with the frame on top only.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking
and
about.
And sort of the green tint on mm-hmm. the sunglasses. He wore those on Moonlighting.
I just don't remember that.
Fucking coolest thing ever. So I had two pairs of sunglasses in high school largely.
I haven't seen Moonlighting in forever.
I love that show.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so weird cartoonish hat. He's setting up the movie in a very like you don't know what's going on yet, and it's hard for me to remember back kind of the first time I saw it. But you know something's going on with this dog
mm-hmm.
just by the way he frames it and the music, and he's building this tension. But you certainly, as a first timer, don't know what is coming.
Yeah. They just do all the shots of just the dog just creeping around by itself. Just
so effective.
And just staring at things. It's like, oh, it's so creepy. Like, what is it thinking?
It is. It really is, because it looks – just the way he shoots it, you can tell that the dog is not a dog almost.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'm retrofitting that in my brain because I know it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems more sentient.
The dog they have, I guess the trained dog, the things that they got it to do are great. How they got it to walk down the hall and stop at certain places and
uh-huh.
just creep into rooms. The training that must have went into it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've worked with animals on set. It's
I've seen animals on set not behave very well.
Yeah. It's always sort of a pain. And animal wranglers are always so weird. It's so funny.
They're usually pretty nice.
No, they're always super nice.
But yeah, I've seen a lot of dogs not do anything they're supposed to do on set.
Yeah, I feel like every animal wrangler I ever worked with was like this woman
mm-hmm.
who looked like she was from the 1970s still, who always just had long straight hair parted down the middle and like had this very special relationship with animals.
Mm-hmm. Like she just happened to have a lot of cats and a lot of dogs. It's like, oh, wait, maybe I can make a little money off this.
I felt so bad for these dogs, man. That scene, the dog pen scene, is so upsetting.
Oh, it was actually like Stan Winston did the special effects for that one scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But with the dog and like the tentacles coming out of its back.
God,
and
it's so upsetting.
It splits open and its skull comes out.
It splits open four ways like a fucking banana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like really quick when it splits open and you see just the skull of the dog and then the skull falls and there's just like this weird tongue thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's over the movie as a whole is just over the top grotesque,
mm-hmm.
which I love. And But that's one of the reasons why it got hammered so bad by critics at first.
Mm-hmm.
Was they just felt it was just so gratuitous.
Which is weird because, like, I even as a kid, I never thought it was – it never grossed me out in a way like a slasher movie would.
Same.
Like, because it's like the gore in this is so, you know, not human. It's like a monster being torn apart.
It's a cartoon.
Yeah, I never thought of it as gross. It never bothered me.
No, absolutely the same thing here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like seeing human beings get, you know, tortured or – you know, slashed or beaten, especially beaten.
Mm.
It's just like very visceral and like I take that on as something that could happen to me maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the same way. This never bothered me at all because I would read those magazines and I would see the like Fangoria when they would do those articles on Stan Winston and like kind of how it's all done.
Mm-hmm.
It never upset me.
Yeah, yeah. It never bothered me. And there's some very intense stuff that happens in this movie.
Oh, man.
And Karen, she can't watch it.
Yeah.
She's like, is this a gross part? And then she would like run out of the room.
Interesting. What's your big moment, monster and effects wise?
The whole scene with the Norse character on the table and they're,
yeah,
you know, and his arm plunged to the stomach.
That's the one.
And it bites his arms off and then his head like rips off.
His torso becomes a bear trap.
Yeah.
Basically. It's the moment of the movie. Like in a movie with a bunch of great, like, gory mm-hmm. moments. That's the one.
That's the one that's always stood out. You know, and it bites the guy's arms off. And they actually had a guy that was a double amputee and they had fake arms on him. So
he actually tore
the fake arms off. So when he pulled back, it was a guy that actually didn't have arms. And it was just like the weird stumps that they put on him. And then when his head comes off the table and it's all the stretchy tentacles and then the spider legs come out of it.
Oh,
it's like
God, dude.
It just doesn't stop. It just keeps going.
Yeah, yeah. It really he's one-upping himself constantly in this movie. Carpenter is. Who's the guy, Botten?
I think it's
Botten.
Botten, yeah.
Rob Botten,
yeah,
like legend.
Who was only like 21 or 22 at the time doing this.
I know. He was a kid.
He was a kid.
And retired like too early.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's still young. He could be working.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up and I mean he's got a legendary resume. And I know he's been like well respected in the creature community.
Yeah. So I think he did The Howling right before this.
Yeah.
Which is another one of my favorite movies.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Fucking unbelievable. Oh, another thing that really struck me watching this time was his use of the flares and using flares as practical lighting.
Oh, yeah. Which is like such
so cool.
A contrast between like all the blue
and
coldness of everything and then like that bright pink.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's so cool because it creates a bit of a lens flare at the same time. But I guess against all that icy sort of white and blue everywhere – the contrast is really, really cool.
Yeah, because I know John Carpenter wanted everything to be very muted and kind of bland looking inside the building.
Uh-huh.
Then everything outside is either just white or blue. And then so just to have that hot pink light of the flares is – I know it was always like a kind of a shocking thing to see because it was like – it kind of comes out of nowhere because there's no other lights like that in the whole movie. And then all of a sudden, boom, that pink.
Yeah. And he
explodes.
Does it a lot too.
Yeah. They wind up using it a lot towards the end.
Uh-huh. Very effective. And then for me as a kid, like I don't know what it is. Maybe it's like the sort of summer campy thing. But like anytime they – like those opening scenes where it showed the guys like all like playing ping pong and all huddled around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of the same in Alien. There was something about those – places and those sets where I wanted to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like a cool, like as a kid.
It's like a clubhouse.
Exactly. I mean, that rec room, it had like arcade games, pool tables, and there was alcohol. I mean, not as a kid.
Sure.
Alcohol, but now it's, you know.
Yeah.
I'd love to go hang out there.
I would totally love to go hang out there in Antarctica. It's still not clear what they're doing, or is it? Did I miss that?
It just says they're doing research, but
right.
I know there's two of the people are biologists, and one of the guys is like a meteorologist, but it doesn't really say what they're actually researching while they're
right.
there.
But it's not – it has nothing to do with aliens.
Mm-mm.
Like this is all just bad luck.
Exactly, yeah. And like it never says if the Norwegians were actually looking for aliens or if they were just doing research and stumbled upon it.
Right.
You know, because they could have like – find out something was there and went there specifically to go find it. But I don't know. It never says, which I love movies that do that, that don't feel they have to explain everything.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Same here. Mm-hmm. And the movie, like, I think I unfairly tagged it as a Alien, not ripoff, but like it's so close to Alien in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But until I did the research about the original book, like it's true to that book. It's not a ripoff of Alien. If anything, Alien ganked from the original thing book, you know. But they are very similar.
Oh yeah, which is like it's one of my favorite. I don't know if it's a genre. Which I just love the stories where it's like a small group of people
isolated
that are totally isolated.
Yeah, man.
And there's no chance of hope. Uh-huh. You know, there's nobody. There's nobody coming to save them.
Yep.
And they have to fight this. That's why I love like The Thing and Alien and Predator. It's like they're just all by themselves having to fight this thing that's way bigger than them.
Yeah, yeah. Like this boss that – and in this movie, the final boss is just like ridiculous.
Oh, the Blair monster.
Yeah, yeah. Man. Yeah, that was Blair, right? Mm-hmm. Well, he very effectively well, real quick, by the way, I have to say when I look up – when I watch movies now, I do a lot of cross-referencing of ages. Mm-hmm. Like how old was this person when they made that movie? Because as I get older, I'm just constantly upset by these revelations. But – Wilford Brimley, dude, was a fucking year older than I am now when he made this movie.
Really?
And I'm like, Wilford Brimley always was 80. Like, how is that possible?
Like, even in that movie, he looks...
He's 48, dude.
But he looks like 60.
Well, and that, to be fair, I did... they actually wrote about that, how Wilford Brimley always looked way older and was cast way older. So it made me feel a little bit better. But when I first saw he was 48, I was so upset. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be 48 in like 4 months. I'm going to be Wilford Brimley's age in The Thing. But he very effectively gets rid of him and they isolate him by himself. Mm-hmm. And as a viewer, you forget he's there.
You do for a long time until they're like, oh, we're going to go check him after they do the whole blood test scene.
Uh-huh.
And then you're like, oh, we should go test him. And then...
I forgot. I've seen this movie a bunch of times, mm-hmm. and I even found myself sort of forgetting. It's like, oh, yeah. Fuck, man. This is not going to be good.
Yeah.
He's been in there by himself, and the thing has been having its way with him, basically.
I read somewhere where John Carpenter wanted him to be, like, kind of a – he got assimilated very early on.
Oh, okay.
And then kind of forgotten about, so, you know, you don't really know.
That's why he became the super boss.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why he was like destroying everything. So he wanted to trap everybody there.
Yeah. And that one great scene. This is so classic. The, you know, I feel better now.
Yeah. I want to come inside. I feel a lot better.
I feel a lot better. I'd like to be let out and
and there's like a noose.
He's made his own noose.
I feel a lot better. I'm not going to hurt anybody.
I love that Kurt Russell just kind of closes that door. He's like, no,
nah, it's not going to happen. Nah, we'll see. We'll see.
But yeah, his boss is great. I think the moment for me, though, still is the chest becoming the bear trap or the head spider. When the which guy is it that where his head basically becomes the body of the spider?
Oh, well, that I think it's that scene where
is it that same one?
Yeah, because like his chest becomes a bear trap, and then while they're shooting with the flamethrower,
right.
his head that they off camera like you know
oh that's right
yeah peels off the table and becomes a spider and crawls
that's
around
when it grows legs
yeah and it goes out the door and they're like. You gotta be fucking kidding me!
Yeah, like that line is so great because as a audience member, you're thinking exactly that.
Yeah, you're like, oh my
like,
God,
seriously,
really? The head became a spider,
and I love that it's never explained. Like, you don't need anything. It's just and I know that he got some grief for it at the time, but Carpenter's always defended that choice, being like, you don't need to explain what this is.
Yeah,
how it got here. I mean, it should. The spaceship, you didn't even need to show that.
Yeah. And even like Kurt Russell's character even says is like, you know, it's different from us.
Yeah.
We don't know what it is. You know, how am I supposed to know what it is? We just know that it's different.
Yeah.
You know, and that's enough of an explanation to know that, yeah, you don't know what to expect from it.
Yeah. And then, you know, it becomes that whodunit thing. And the tension at that point when they're all like, you know, it could be any one of us is just such a great thing to do in a movie.
The blood test scene when they're actually trying to figure out who it is.
So like, great.
Oh, it's okay.
And that's in the book.
Is it?
Yeah.
I've never read the book.
Well, I didn't read it, but I read the big plot synopsis, and mm-hmm. they do that. They draw blood, and he uses a piece of hot coiled wire.
Nice.
And it's just like straight up from the book. And it's so tense every time that thing touches the blood, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, you don't know who it's going to be. And then you don't know, like, what the reaction from the blood will
be. Yeah. Is there even going to be one?
Right.
Until it explodes out.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God, it's so good.
Yeah, so effective. And then everyone, you know, it's like that – it's almost like a Russian roulette or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, each dude – and they're all tied together, which is great because when – who is it that's revealed in that scene? What's the character?
Palmer.
Yeah, Palmer's revealed.
Yeah.
And he starts, you know, thinging, mm-hmm. and everyone's just like, fucking untied.
They're all tied up right next to him. Get yeah. me the fuck out of here.
It was so great. And what's the one great line? Like, I don't want to be tied to this fucking chair.
Oh, yeah. He was like, I know you guys have been through a lot, but yeah. I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch.
It's so great. Oh, man. I have it just on my notes here in all caps with exclamation points. Blood test scene.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, it's funny. In that blood test scene, that flamethrower, a lot of great flamethrower shit in this movie.
A lot, yeah.
But it malfunctions
mm-hmm.
just long enough for the thing to fully realize, which becomes like the greatest gift to the audience. Because you could have just zapped him immediately.
Yeah. But then he things out and then winds up killing the character Windows.
Yeah.
With the whole like lifting them up off the...
Oh, God.
Like
so
his head
great.
Splits open, bites the other guy, and is like swinging him around the place.
It's so good.
It's a little comical when you look at it now because it's like...
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, obviously a fake body with fake legs kicking, but it's...
Yeah, but that's sort of the B-moviness of it that still like mm-hmm. – that's why this movie holds up, I think, mm-hmm. is because you don't judge it through today's standards.
But even today's standards, it's still an amazing movie.
Yeah.
A lot of it does hold up compared to now. It's
yeah. I mean the effects are the effects. Like they are mm-hmm. early 80s effects, which are super impressive if you can like put your head in that – if you can judge it for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like CG – like, this is real shit.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's made out of slime and plastic.
And melted plastic and melted bubblegum and a lot of other chemicals, and they almost blew up the set.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that the set with the – when the head was, you know, peeling off the body,
uh-huh.
all the stuff in the neck apparently was toxic and releasing toxic fumes.
That didn't surprise me.
And right before they were about to shoot it, John Carpenter's like, oh, wait, they're supposed to be flames because they're, you know, using a flamethrower on his stomach. So they go and they light the thing, and this huge fireball apparently just, you know, blows up in the room.
Wow.
And they're like, you know, fortunately it didn't, you know, hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And they were able to save the prop, but.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, but they almost killed everybody.
Jeez, man. I know that they shot some of the exteriors in like Alaska.
It was in British Columbia.
Oh, okay.
Stewart, British Columbia. I think there was a little bit shot in Alaska, but like the actual the outpost, uh-huh. the base was in British Columbia.
Okay.
Yeah.
But and then all the interiors were just refrigerated sets.
Sound stages in LA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's so funny, man. The magic of movies. I always get fooled, which is great. So then we get to the end, you know, that great final like 15 minutes when the guys are, you know, dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
They basically decide, well, they always split up, which is so funny in this movie because the one. Of all movies,
mm-hmm.
this is like the movie where you should always have
a buddy.
You should
always stay together.
Yeah.
never leave one person by themselves.
Right.
And they do. They leave Childs, like Keith David. They leave him by himself.
Oh, he's so good in this, too.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Love that guy.
But they're like, you just wait here and we'll go do this other thing. And they leave him alone. It's like, why would you leave anybody alone?
Yeah. They all, you know, especially when they're – and I mean, I guess they're trying to blow the place up,
mm-hmm.
like in quick order so they can't all stay together. But it's just that tension is just ratcheting up. Over that last 15 minutes with the, you know, inevitable explosion of mm-hmm. kind of everything.
Yeah, when they're going down into the generator room with all those giant barrels of oil and
yeah.
like the generator, like it's just gone. Like the thing just took it.
Yeah.
Instead of just blowing it up, it's just gone. So like there's no hope of getting any heat back.
And,
like,
yeah. What? I mean, none of that is ever explained, obviously.
Well, I think it took it. So their heat would be gone. You know, there's
and how did it take it? Where did it go?
Where did it go?
Right.
Well, I mean it's strong enough to burrow underground.
Oh.
Could have hidden it.
Okay.
Could have thrown it outside somewhere.
Right.
But yeah, it is one of those things like, where did it go?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And Kurt Russell has one of the great last lines. Well, fuck you too.
It's just in there screaming at him. He's like, well, fuck you too. And just throws it right at it.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
If you look at the monster, you can see half of Blair's head is coming out of the big monster head on one side. It's like Blair's face is on the other. Like Wilford Brimley's face is like coming out of the other side.
It's just so badass,
yeah,
man.
It's so cool.
Well, in the I think what made it creepy too was the those faces still being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that it took over a host body. So that host body's still there in a certain way. So you could just make it so grotesque.
Yeah, because like, you know, it'll add like pieces of dog and pieces of like human. But then there's also other alien bits from, you know, aliens that other aliens it's assimilated 100,000 years ago. It's like all that stuff is all combined into this one thing.
Yeah, because it's from the past, right? Didn't they say that the spaceship was like 100,000?
It's been frozen for about 100,000 years, yeah.
Which is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
So the reviews, I did not know because I grew up in the, as you did, with the sort of in the midst of the reevaluation period when it became a hit on VHS and I guess like HBO and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it really got killed.
It did. It barely made its money back.
And I mean, some of the magazines that you would think should be behind it, Cine Fantastique, I know, was in a movie magazine that ordinarily would support stuff like The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, is it the most hated movie of all time? Dismissed by some as instant junk, wretched excess. LA Times, Linda Gross said it was bereft, despairing, and nihilistic. Newsweek magazine said the film confused the use of effects with creating suspense and that it lacked drama by sacrificing everything at the altar of gore. and it had a real impact on Carpenter. Apparently he was going to direct Firestarter, but was not fired, but like not given that opportunity. And then he had a multiple film contract at the time that Universal opted to buy him out of.
Yeah.
It was such a failure.
Which is crazy because it's such an amazing movie.
I don't get it.
I don't get how people didn't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
But then, like we said, on VHS, there was a critical reevaluation over the years. And now it has since been called like one of the best films of the year, one of the great sci-fi horror movies of all time. Which is pretty cool. Like Carpenter at least can feel good about it after all these years.
Yeah. I think a lot of it probably didn't do so well was because it came out like – I think like E.T. came out the week before or something.
Yeah. Well, that did not help.
And it didn't help, yeah. Everybody was like riding that happy feel-good alien vibe. And then this movie came along and was like, not that.
82 is a crazy year though because like Blade Runner came out that year.
Came out the same day as The Thing.
Oh, that's right.
They got released on the same day and neither one of them did well.
Yeah.
Did
Blade Runner get critically panned at the time? Or?
I don't know, but I know it didn't do well in the box office.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it just like The Thing, it became like a big cult hit afterwards.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's so crazy. 82. E.T. really like ruined everything. Such a good movie though. Mm-hmm. I was into all of it, you know?
Yeah, me too. I can watch any movie. I love watching movies.
Yeah.
I'll watch everything.
Yeah.
For a while, I was working at a video store and a movie theater at the same time.
Wow.
I was a projectionist at a theater.
Oh, cool.
And I just watched movies all the time.
Wow. So you were a projectionist, huh?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Oh, it was great. It was one of my favorite jobs I've ever had.
Yeah.
It was from 2001 to 2004.
Cool.
And it was a small 8-screen theater in Decatur, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
So it was like all still film at the time.
Yeah.
Building movies, putting all the movies together.
Yeah.
I loved it.
My brother was a general manager at the Phipps AMC for a while. He went to a few, but that was the one mainly where he worked. And so he would take me up in the projection booth and the dudes would show me how it worked. And it was just so fucking cool.
It was one of the best jobs I've ever had. And I almost got a job at the Plaza here in town when I first moved here. But I was doing a video for weddings.
Uh-huh.
And I had like one weekend left to do this video. And that's the weekend they wanted me to start working at the Plaza. And right. So like, I couldn't get out of the other thing. And so they wound up hiring somebody else. But
could you still do it? You still got the chops?
I don't know. Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such muscle memory, you know, because you're basically just doing the same motions over and over again when you're threading everything.
Right.
I could do it pretty quick. I could, you know, build a movie and it was like 35 minutes.
How many different cans do they come on?
An average movie usually came on like 2 cans and like 6 reels.
Okay.
But then I was also building the trailer reels and the commercial reels.
Like, uh-huh.
And just putting everything together. I could do like 4 or 5 movies in a night.
Wow.
Yeah.
You never told me you were a projectionist, dude. Oh. That's awesome.
Yeah, I did that. And I've worked at 5 different video stores.
Yeah, I did that in college mm-hmm. for a little while. I worked at Vision Video in Athens.
Oh, nice.
Which was one of the greats.
Yeah, I got to go visit that before it closed down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very sadly.
Very sad.
Did you work at one here in town?
No.
No.
It was in Auburn, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
I lived there up before I moved here and I worked at 2 different ones there and then 2 in Decatur, Alabama, and then 1 in – I lived in Nashville for a year.
Oh, cool.
So I was like a manager at a Blockbuster there.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So, man, you were working at a theater, working at a video store, so you were just fully immersed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I every movie that came into the theater I watched, mostly to make sure that I put it together right.
Right.
But, yeah, I would just watch everything.
What – when you're putting a movie – we're getting so like derailed here at the end.
Sorry. But
it's like the coolest job to me is projectionist. You so you put the movie together, you start the screening, mm-hmm. and then do you immediately have to hustle to the next one, or is there downtime?
There's usually the start times were staggered a little bit.
Yeah.
So I could you know thread it. It only took like a minute to thread it and get it started. Uh-huh. And I could go to the next one and thread that and get it started.
And then it's like quality control.
Mm-hmm. And then after I had all of them done, then I would basically go down and. Go actually walk into the theater to make sure the sound was right, the picture looked clear.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, yeah, it's great.
That's an important, like so many of them, I'm glad like you took it seriously. I think most projectionists do.
Yeah, because I watching movies is like an escape for me.
Yeah.
I love getting like super into it uh-huh. and just kind of like losing myself in the movie. And
yeah.
I never want anybody to get taken out of that experience.
Yeah.
So.
Awesome. That's God's work, my friend. All right, man. Well, that's the thing. Let's finish up with the 5 questions.
Nice.
I didn't pull a quote from Ebert. I usually do what Ebert said, but he did give it 2.5 stars. And mm-hmm. his take was basically like, you know, some people are going to love this thing. It is what it is. Like he didn't shit on it.
He was just like, whatever.
But he didn't like sing its praises either,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. What is the first movie you saw in the theater?
The first one that I can – vividly remember seeing in the theater was probably like Return of the Jedi.
Mm.
I can remember going to – this was back when the theater was inside the mall in my hometown before it, you know, moved outside the mall and was in its own building.
Yeah.
But I remember my mom taking me. I remember her and I going like 3 times to see it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Dude, your mom sounds fucking cool as shit.
Oh, she's great.
That's awesome. My mom's great too, but they just didn't have great – cultural tastes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, even with my dad, when I would go stay with my dad, he was also like super into movies too.
It's yeah.
like he loves action, science fiction. He loved all that too. So I got it from both of them.
Yeah. This all makes sense now
mm-hmm.
of who Craig Johnson is. what was the first R-rated movie that you saw?
The first one I saw in the theater that I snuck into was probably Terminator 2.
Yeah.
But like just seeing R-rated, I don't know. I saw a lot of movies very young that were R-rated.
Yeah,
just going to friends' house and staying up late and watching.
Yep.
You know, being like 8 years old watching something on HBO.
Right.
Middle of the night. I don't know. There's a lot that I saw.
Yeah. So you were in there.
Yeah.
Earlier than you should have been.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. I didn't have cable or satellite growing up.
Oh, okay.
So.
Why rural or
rural? Yeah, we lived kind of too far off the road for them to run a cable
uh-huh.
and satellite. We just couldn't really afford it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I got cable way late.
Yeah, all of my cousins had it. A lot of my friends had it. So
uh-huh.
every time I'd go to their house, I would bring VHS tapes to record movies.
Yeah.
So I had stacks of VHS recorded movies.
That's great. Number 3, will you walk out of a bad movie?
I've never walked out of a movie.
I believe that.
I can usually, even if I'm not enjoying the story, I can usually, or I mean, if I'm not enjoying it, I can still get into the story.
Mm-hmm.
And once I start it, I usually want to see how it ends.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like maybe I have to finish it. I just want to know how it ends.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. It's good. Respect for I've had a lot of people that say sort of like, I feel like I almost owe the respect of finishing this thing because, you know, especially as a crew member, mm-hmm. just how much work goes into it.
A lot. So much work.
Yeah.
Months and months of just filming, and that's not included like the prep ahead of time and all the post work. It's a lot of work.
Do you find yourself sort of looking at sets a lot more now that you do that kind of work, or can you just sort of forget about all that?
I try to just forget about it because I don't want to pick apart movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to experience them.
Yeah.
And I try not to figure out what's going to happen in a movie.
Right.
Like, I don't want to know.
Right.
I want the movie to, you know, surprise me. It's like, if there is like a whodunit, I don't want to try to figure out who did it.
That's cool, man.
I just want to watch it.
Emily gets mad at me sometimes because I'm like, oh, you know what's totally going to happen. Yeah. She's like, shut up. I don't want to know what's totally going to happen what you think it's totally going to happen.
Ideas do pop in my head, like, you know, what I think will happen, but I try to keep it to myself and try to forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to watch it. I just want to experience it.
Yeah, that's cool. It's funny, too, though. Sometimes I'll do that. Or Emily will say a line that they say or something, like mm-hmm. finish a line before they do.
Yeah.
And it's most times like a tropey line. But we always will say to each other, I could write this shit. That's like our ongoing joke. I could write this shit.
I could write this.
I tailor this one to the guest, number four. So let me think. What's a good one for you? I'm going to throw you a music curveball. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite 80s band and or song?
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Get back on that.
Yeah, I love the Cars so much.
Great pick.
But I also love like...
that debut album of theirs. One of the best debut albums of all time.
It's so good.
It's like a greatest hit.
Mm-hmm.
That was their first record.
Yeah, Rick Ocasek and Benjamin Ward.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
They're both so good.
What was the other one you were going to say?
But I also love like Hall & Oates.
I know you do.
I love Hall & Oates. But,
great.
I grew up listening, you know, hearing all that on the radio. Also, I was a big Huey Lewis in the News fan as a kid.
Yeah, me too.
As a kid. That was like my first concert I ever went to was Huey Lewis in the News.
Yeah.
I think I was like 10 years old and my mom wanted to go, so we went together.
I was into them too, man.
Yeah.
It's funny. And it's funny they had a song called Hip to Be Square
yeah.
because looking back, like, they weren't the coolest band in the world.
No, definitely not.
But I was way into it. Yeah. I was not ashamed.
Yeah, I loved it.
I think we had very similar, like, we were a lot alike probably growing up.
I think so.
You know? Sweet little church kids. Is there any better song than You Make My Dreams Come True? I mean, man.
It's so good.
The beginning of that song, every single time just gets me. I don't even know what that is. What are they playing? What is that?
I don't know. I'd have to hear it.
What is that? Is that a keyboard?
Probably.
Yeah, that's got to be it. And then finally, Movie Going 101, mm-hmm. when you get to – you still go to the theater a lot probably, right?
Yeah, as much as I can.
Yeah.
I love going to the theater.
What's your jam? What's your ritual?
I usually – when I was a kid, I would always get like a Coke and the whole – bag of like the family pack size of Twizzlers
mm-hmm.
and just eat the whole thing myself.
Mm-hmm.
But now I like a theater where I can get a beer.
Oh.
I love getting a drink at the movie theater.
Okay.
And sometimes,
so Midtown's great for that. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we'll go to the Highlander and have a drink or two before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know.
Little boozy movies then.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I love having a little bit of a buzz going to watch a movie.
Yeah. Okay.
But as far as like where I sit, I usually like I like sitting in the middle or maybe a little bit towards the back. It depends on how big the theater is.
Right.
If it's like a big, huge theater, I like sitting that seat that's like the first one up on the stadium where there's like the bars
mm-hmm.
that you can put your feet up on.
Yeah. Everyone loves that.
I love that so
I
much.
I never do that move. I should do that.
It's comfortable because you can kind of relax.
Yeah. I've been moving closer lately, I've mm-hmm. noticed, because I had been sitting pretty far back. And like, oh, I'd just like to have the whole thing in my field of vision.
Yeah.
But I've been going a little closer, and it's mm-hmm. a bit more immersive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah. It's interesting. I found myself just easing. And this is on my going to see movies by myself because Emily doesn't mm-hmm. want to sit close. But we never get to the movies, like, together. It's rare.
Yeah. It's gotten harder and harder for Karen and I to go to the movies together because our schedules are so different
yeah.
from work.
and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's hard to go together a lot of the time.
I know, it's ironic that people that work on movies are some of the biggest movie lovers and they never get to go to the movies because they're working so much.
Exactly. But I also know a lot of people that work in the business and they're like, yeah, it's just a job.
Well,
and they're like,
that is true.
Yeah.
There's,
it's like half.
I'm not going to mention which departments,
yeah.
But some departments are more full of film lovers than others.
Absolutely.
And some are just like, no, man, this gets me my jet ski.
Exactly.
Every summer at my lake house. I won't talk about grips and electrics. What? That is funny that way, though. Mm-hmm. It's sort of just like a little more like a blue collar, like union job for some of these people.
For a lot of people, yeah.
But it's also, you're right, it's also like half just like film junkies.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty great.
Yeah. On Stranger Things, I got to work with one of the guys that was the first AC, like the focus puller,
mm-hmm.
that he worked on The Thing.
Oh, wow.
And it was like his first movie.
Really?
And he was also the focus puller on season one of Stranger Things.
Wow.
Like he was still doing it. Pretty amazing.
Did you pepper him with questions?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was super nice about it and he was excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's usually the case.
Mm-hmm.
All right, dude. Well, this was great.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, man. All right, everyone. I enjoyed that. Craig, I was super excited to learn at the end there that he was a projectionist. I wish I would have known that going in. We would have front-loaded that stuff. Such a cool job. And I'm glad that he was able to sort of illuminate us as to what that job is like and what that entails. Very cool. Like that's the final watchman for the quality of a film projection is that projectionist. So it was really neat to learn about that and to hear about his work on Stranger Things, season 3. His music was Space Knife. Go check that out. And then the great discussion we had about The Thing. You could tell Craig loves this movie, and it's just. One of the great all-time sci-fi horror films. And I'm glad it is recognized as such now. I don't know what critics were thinking back then. I guess they weren't ready for it. They were not ready for how awesome that movie was. but thankfully, it was reevaluated over the years and is now a classic film. And one of the best of 1982, which is one of the best years in film for me. So I hope you enjoyed it. Go watch The Thing if you haven't. I'm going to check out that prequel now that I know it's a prequel. For sure. Why not, right? And thanks for listening. So until next week, everyone, remember, don't go anywhere without that bottle of J&P Scotch. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.